Thank you for tuning in to KUOW's The Record. A good Monday to you. I'm Bill Radke. A young man from Burma, a family from Iran, and a father with three kids from Somalia. All of them have just arrived here in the Seattle area, and you will hear their stories on KUOW in the coming weeks. It's part of a project produced by our race and culture reporter, Liz Jones. Liz tracked these refugees from the moment they arrived until about 8 months into their stay. That's when their federal benefits run out, and they're on their own to make it in America. Liz told me she got the idea for this project about a year ago when the Syrian war started to escalate and we saw the waves of new refugees hitting Europe.
So, you know, as we're seeing a lot of reaction to this migration crisis, we're seeing that here locally, too. We're seeing a lot of locals jumping in and saying, who are these people? How can we help? What do we do? Where do they go? So I thought one of the best ways to try to answer that question would be to follow a few refugees through their life, through their first year here, and see what it's like for them.
Tell us about the refugees you followed.
Yeah, so they all arrived within the past year, and they're all from very different places, very different situations. And I'll use a little bit of tape from each of them to introduce who they are, a little bit about them. So the first one is a young man named Tutu. He's from Myanmar, also known as Burma. And Burmese refugees are one of the largest resettlement groups here in the U.S. in the past decade. Tutu spent his whole life in a refugee camp. And here's just a cut of him talking with an interpreter about what his camp was like.
Lots of trees.
Yeah.
What did you think of it there? Was it an okay place?
It's a good place.
Why did you want to come here?
My dad wanted me to come here, so I listened to him and I came here. At first, I don't really want to come.
So one of the challenges with Tutu is his English. He got off the plane here and immediately wanted to just spend as much time as he could in English classes, but was feeling also the pressure to get a job and earn money right away. So we'll see how his story unravels. The next is a couple from Iran. It's Netta and Payman, and they're a married couple. They left Iran in 2012 and then spent about 3 years in Turkey as refugees. And life there for them was very difficult. They described it as a garbage can. They were undocumented, basically, there, so couldn't legally work. And this clip is Payman. This is the day after they arrived here, and they're living in Kent. And he's just talking about his future.
Future is hard. The way is hard. I come here because in my city I had problem. Now here started new life, and we need practice, learning everything.
So again, English will be a bit of a challenge with him and with all the refugees who come here. This is a common theme. And Netta and Payman run into some unexpected obstacles in their job search here and some other surprises for their plans. And they end up shifting plans pretty dramatically along their journey here. And then the last one is a young man named Osman. He's about 27. He's from Somalia. He came here with his wife and three young daughters. And let me just have him introduce himself with this clip here.
But now here I'm feeling lots of a challenge. While I am an African boy, I came from Kenya and I was been a refugee almost 20 something years. I was a refugee almost 30 years, you know, because of we ran from our country, because we were being discriminated a lot. We were people who are just a minority tribe. We like to be in a safe conditions, you know. We are not a people of a war. We like peace. We depend on peace.
So what Osman has going for him is stronger English, but he did spend most of his life in a refugee camp. Somali refugees here, one of the largest resettlement groups coming to the U.S. in the past decade or so. Washington's the third most popular place for resettlement for Somalis. And part of Osman's story is he's been through a lot of trauma in his life, and he comes here and has some rare setbacks that are not common for most refugees. So he really gets dealt kind of a tough hand here, and you'll hear his story as the series unfolds.
Could you say broadly, how typical are their stories and situations? How typical of refugees who come to the Puget Sound area?
Well, of course, they all come from unique backgrounds, unique challenges, unique personal challenges, but they have so many similarities and so much in common. I think a common theme for all of them is they're leaving despair and coming here looking for hope and opportunity. Something I heard a lot was everybody was homesick. They were missing their relatives that they left behind. Everybody said, this is not what I expected. It's a lot harder than I expected. Everybody said, I need a car to make it in America. Everybody just needed a car. They ended up commuting so much on bus, transit, 2 hours each way to their jobs and probably needing a second job. But how do you make that work when you're commuting 4 hours a day?
Talking with race and culture reporter Liz Jones, and you've spent the last year learning about how refugee resettlement works. What are some of your big takeaways?
As I was working on these stories with the new refugees, I also met a lot of their relatives who had been here longer. And some of them, you know, here 7, 10 years, still kind of working the same jobs, still with pretty low levels of English. One family I met said, you know, in the 7 years they'd been here, they'd been to a movie one time. They saw Harry Potter with their son. Never been on a vacation, maybe one overnight somewhere. So it takes a while for their lives to kind of progress and to find some stability here.
We've talked about how resettling refugees is a flashpoint in this presidential campaign. Liz, over the last year, how did you see that fact affect the refugees you met and the people who work with them?
I profiled just 3 refugee cases, but I met dozens more along the way. And to a large extent, I think how this is affecting them is sometimes they're keeping a little bit of a low profile. They're worried that the U.S. may close its doors to more refugees and what happens to their relatives who are still in refugee camps or still facing dangerous situations back in their home countries.
That's KUOW's race and culture reporter Liz Jones. And you can hear the first part of her series tomorrow here on The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Seattle civil rights activist Bob Santos died over the weekend. Santos was one of the Gang of Four, 4 men who headed up multicultural activism in Seattle in the 60s and 70s. I really enjoyed his one-man show, Uncle Bob's Neighborhood. That one was about the fights over the Kingdome coming to the International District in the 70s. Well, 2 years ago at the StoryCorps booth in Seattle's New Holly neighborhood, author Lulu Carpenter asked Bob Santos why, at 81 years of age, he was so often asked to talk to young people.
Well, my background is I have the most exciting background that I know of. living with working in the International District, Chinatown, Manilatown, Japantown of Seattle. And, of course, don't forget now, I grew up in the 30s, the early 30s. So you're talking about a neighborhood where my parents and my colleagues, their parents from China, Japan, Philippines, were segregated into this little neighborhood. Unlike other major urban areas like San Francisco, New York, you had a separate Chinatown, you had a separate Japantown, separate Manila town. Mm-hmm. In the International District of Seattle, of course, we were segregated into the same neighborhood. So, and we also had African Americans and Native Americans in our community, along with, you know, the Nordic American people from the timber industry and the fishing industry. So I grew up in a wonderful, wonderful neighborhood of all these mixed ethnicities and cultures.
Mm-hmm. What was your role in the International District?
Well,
as a young person,
my first role, of course, Lulu, was growing up. And my father was joined the U.S. Navy in the Philippines in 1919. And as he got close to shore here in San Diego, he got in a little fight with a junior officer. And before they docked, or as they were docking, somehow he jumped ship. Mm-hmm. And my dad was on the loose. He jumped ship, and he had no skills, but he liked to fight. So he became a professional prize fighter, mm-hmm. and he changed his name because the shore patrol, the military security people were looking for him. He changed his name from Macario Santos to Sammy Santos. Mm-hmm. So he became a professional prize fighter, and He started his career, did very well there. He reached the main event status, where that means that he was the top boxer in the card, the top card at that time, at the arena or a civic auditorium where he fought. The shore patrol finally caught him. He was put in the brig. And my dad never told me how long he stayed in the brig, but it had to be at least a year or so. And when he came out, he traveled the West Coast and ended up in Cleveland and Chicago, but decided that the Pacific Northwest was also a good fight town. So he traveled and settled here in Seattle and became a local sports hero, not just in boxing, but because Seattle had no professional sports at that time except the minor league baseball team, the Seattle Rainiers. Dad became a local hero as the prize fighter that represented Seattle. And, of course, being Filipino, he became a hero in our community. So that's how I grew up, as Sammy's Little Boy.
Sammy's Little Boy was your first title.
Sammy's Boy.
That was Bob Santos speaking 2 years ago with author Lulu Carpenter. They were talking at the StoryCorps booth in Seattle's New Holly neighborhood about his work in the International Chinatown District. Bob Santos passed away over the weekend. This is The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. The last anyone heard from Amber Tuckero was August 18th, 2010. Her brother called her from prison while Amber was hitchhiking into Edmonton, Alberta. A man had picked Amber up, and the prison phone system recorded this.
Yo, we're not going in the city, are we?
No, we're not.
Yes. Then where the f*** are these roads going to?
50th Street.
50th Street. Are you sure?
Absolutely.
Amber Tuckero's body was found 2 years later. Her case is unsolved. She is one of more than 1,000 Indigenous Canadian women who went missing or were murdered between 1980 and 2012. Connie Walker is part of a reporting project with the CBC looking at these women's cases, and she told me that Amber Tuckero's case is not that unique.
I think that there are aspects of Amber's story that can be found in so many of the cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women, just in terms of the police investigation to start. When she was first reported missing, the police have now apologized to her family for the way that they handled that case. They admit that they didn't investigate it properly. Her mom says they told her she was out partying or that she was in Edmonton. They gave an interview to a local newspaper saying she'd been spotted in Edmonton when, in fact, they know now that wouldn't have been possible. So I think that is something that's actually a really common theme in so many of the missing and murdered Indigenous women cases is the police response or lack of response by police or lack of investigation. And the other thing I think is really common about Amber's case is the resilience of families and how incredibly strong and what fierce advocates the families of these women are, and how, you know, this is an issue that's been going on for years, if not decades, but it's really been the families who have pushed this issue into the spotlight.
Why would police not take these cases more seriously?
That's a very complicated question, and I think that's something that is going to be definitely at the forefront of the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women inquiry that's set to start at the beginning of September. You know, it's not something that can be seen in isolation. I think that police in general have had not a great history with Indigenous communities in Canada. But also complicating that is just the overrepresentation of Indigenous people in the criminal justice system and the disproportionate rates of violence in communities and how that intersects with police. I think it's something that is definitely going to be investigated.
Why are there so many Indigenous women missing or murdered in Canada?
I think that it's, again, something that can't be seen in a silo, that this is one manifestation of the issues and challenges that Indigenous communities face across the country. And because of these particular vulnerabilities, or because of these particular issues that largely stem from the impacts of residential schools, where the goal was to assimilate them, to strip them of their language, their culture, to remove their connections from families. And that obviously was incredibly devastating to whole generations of Indigenous kids and families across the country. But also colonization, and some advocates and activists would say ongoing discriminatory policies against Indigenous families and children, it's made for very challenging situations. So it's not just the disproportionate rates of violence that Indigenous women face, but it's the levels of poverty, which are so much worse in Indigenous communities than across the country, the lack of access to housing, the lack of investment in education, the overrepresentation in the criminal justice system. I think that all of these things are part of the same issue. So when you're looking at the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women, it really has to be looked at as a part of a bigger picture about what the challenges are that Indigenous communities are facing in Canada.
So there are bigger issues going on here. There's a long history here. What is the government doing now to help solve these cases of missing women?
Well, they've set up this national inquiry, which is set to launch at the beginning of September. And they say the goal of the inquiry is to help end this ongoing issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women by looking at systemic issues. So how institutions like policing, like the child welfare system, like poverty affect Indigenous women, and coming up with concrete solutions to help end that. Obviously, that's a huge task. The commissioners have been given a 2-year mandate to try to accomplish this. And I think that there is some skepticism just in terms of how much they can actually accomplish that is different than previous studies. I mean, obviously, this relationship between Indigenous people and Canada has this, you know, been ongoing for 150 years. And in recent years and decades, there have been a number of commissions and studies that look at some of the same issues that this national inquiry is supposed to look at. So some people say, we know what the solutions are, we know what the issues are, and we know what we need to do to address them. And they're calling on the government to take immediate action and not wait 2 years for this commission to be over to then start taking action.
You are an Indigenous woman, Connie. What do you want people to know about these women who have gone missing?
I think that, like in all of our coverage, what I've always kept top of mind is that, you know, that these women are more than just the statistics that they represent, that these women were incredibly loved and that they have families and communities that still miss them and are still fighting for justice for them. And I think that we wanted to show a bit about how they lived and who they were, as opposed to just focusing on the violence. This is something that Indigenous communities and families have known has been an issue for years, and is really something that the families of missing and murdered Indigenous women have pushed into the spotlight now. And they're saying, we're not going to be ignored, and they're demanding action. So I think that, you know, that's something that this national inquiry is a result of that. And also the mainstream media attention paid to this issue is also because of the families and the work that they're doing.
Connie Walker reports on Indigenous News for the CBC. A federal inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women in Canada is set to begin this week. You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. News and information. In the news today, the company Mylan says it's going to make available a generic version of its EpiPen. That's the handy little device that treats anaphylaxis and saves lives. Consumers and politicians have accused this company of price gouging, as the list price for an EpiPen has climbed from about $50 to almost $300 in less than a decade. The company says the generic will have a list price of $150. Well, right in this area, King County's Emergency Medical Services has developed a cheaper injection kit, less than $20. And the difference is an EpiPen comes with an auto injector, which makes it quite easy to use in an emergency. King County's cheaper kit uses a regular syringe that takes more training to use, so it's not for the general public, but it could be used in schools. Well, KUOW's social media producer, Bon Huberman, our listeners had something to say about all of this.
Hey, Bill.
Hi.
So I don't know a lot about the EpiPen, but our listeners raised some questions that I thought were really interesting. For example, Annie says you need to be able to draw epinephrine into a syringe and give yourself a shot. If you're in the midst of a reaction, that would be really hard. Sharon adds some additional caution. Every time I read or hear someone say this might be a good option for schools, I cringe, she says. Most of the health-related contact your children receive is by teachers and administrators. Nurses are often not present in emergency situations. So ask yourself, she says, if this were your child, would you want an administrative assistant drawing up epinephrine and injecting it?
That's a good question.
And then Katie has a good solution, or a possible solution. She says, I could see a system in school similar to what we have in place for diabetic students. I attend yearly training at Children's Hospital, and then I go to work and hope I never see an emergency. And then finally, Alex wonders, could I go to a specific training, and would that help it be available to the public?
Well, that's a take from some of our listeners. Thank you, Bond. We'd like to hear from you. You can always write to us at record@kuow.org or join the conversation on KUOW's Facebook page. And we're going to take a closer look at the EpiPen and the company that makes it coming up this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. You're listening to The Record. Thanks for tuning in today. This summer, one of the biggest birds in North America suddenly showed up in Puget Sound. Squadrons, and by the way, that is the correct collective noun, squadrons of white pelicans have set local birders a Twitter trying to figure out where they came from and what it means. EarthFix reporter Katie Campbell says the fun for bird watchers might not be so good for the pelicans.
It's a steep hike down to the shores of Padilla Bay.
All right, we got set up here.
But citizen scientists Matt Kirschbaum and Sue Ayler are used to it. As volunteers with a group that's studying the area's heron population, they come here every other week, all summer long.
We make a sweep with the spotting scope from left to right, and we count everything that we see with a hand counter. I call it a tallywhacker.
What was your total count on that one?
210.
210? Okay.
This estuary in northwest Washington is home to thousands of birds, including the largest breeding colony of great blue herons in the Pacific Northwest. Counts like this serve as an annual checkup.
We do have a feel for what's happening out here because we do come regularly.
So they were some of the first to notice the new arrivals.
Matt and I are coming to do our survey. He throws on the brakes. He goes, there they are. And there's 11 pelicans they were like next to here. And it's like seeing aliens arrive. I mean, they aren't here.
Yep, when birders come across an unfamiliar species in their backyards, it's a big deal.
It's unprecedented for them to be here. So something really unusual was happening. Of course, we're having a blast.
The American white pelican's range stretches across much of the country, but not into western Washington. White pelicans have 9-foot wingspans and long orange bills. They're different from brown pelicans, a more common summer visitor to coastal Washington. At first, Kirschbaum and Eiler saw just a handful of white pelicans.
Then we had like 30, and then there were 50. I mean, finally it was up to 100.
Then Eiler put a call out for sightings, and soon heard back from birders across Puget Sound, out on the Olympic Peninsula, and north into coastal British Columbia.
And I've got, oh gosh, easily 75 to 100 reports that have come in.
Normally the region's white pelicans would be at freshwater lakes and rivers farther south and east. They nest on islands where they're safe from predators like coyotes. But parts of Oregon and California are enduring another year of severe drought. And that means prime breeding grounds like Malheur National Wildlife Refuge have gotten so dry that coyotes can walk across the lake beds where pelican nestlings are easy prey. Joe Sheldon has been following the relocation of the pelicans. The retired ecology professor says the pressures of climate change could be at play.
You might describe these as a climate refugee if indeed Malheur has dried to the point where they can no longer feed and breed there.
When it comes to adapting to warmer, drier climates, Sheldon says other species may be worse off. For one, pelicans can fly, and because of that, they've learned to adapt to a range of habitats.
They can tolerate a variety of different temperatures, and in terms of their feeding niches, they're also relatively broad. So the broader the niche, the more tolerant they tend to be.
But that doesn't mean pelicans are in the clear.
If conditions deteriorate on the breeding range because of habitat destruction, climate change, or other factors, they either have to find a new location or indeed they will go extinct.
So the pelicans in Puget Sound could be pioneers searching for a site for a new colony. A recent study has found that pelican colonies across the country have been shifting north by about 200 miles over the last 50 years. But it's too soon to say if these pelicans are just Puget Sound tourists or new summer residents. On Padilla Bay, I'm Katie Campbell.
This is The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. After getting the $15 minimum wage, Seattle's retail and service workers may claim another victory. The city is drafting a law known as Secure Scheduling. It's aimed at giving employees more control over their hours and the shifts they work. Businesses that don't comply might have to pay a penalty to their employees. David Jones is a Subway franchisee and the founder of the Blazing Onion restaurant chain. He says this law would punish too many businesses who are doing nothing wrong.
It's more of a handful. It's not the majority. I think the majority of business owners, whether it's retail or restaurants, 95% or more are doing a good job with taking care of their employees, talking to their employees, communicating with their employees, making good schedules.
How do you know that doing a good job with scheduling is the rule?
Well, I used to teach scheduling, so I've taught it for a long time. I worked for Denny's for 13 years and did the training for the managers and traveled to actually do the schedules. And the people I talk to, there's no reason to make a bad schedule. It's just laziness to make a bad schedule. So if you want to stop turnover, you are trying to always take care of your people. That's your goal all the time. And any other goal is lazy where you don't realize that you're causing a problem for yourself.
But I think I hear you saying that that scheduling problems are a relatively small problem. And I want to know how. You know, not everybody agrees. So what's your evidence that this is not a big problem?
Well, for one thing, the city council just had a public hearing and the press was there, and the stories after the press was there was that employees came and talked about it and then business owners came and talked about it. And that's not what happened. What happened was roughly five employees from the city's argument came and spoke, and about five employees from the business side came and spoke. The rest of it was all union and business owners. It's not a big employee outcry that's showing up at these things.
You're saying in your experience, shift scheduling is not a problem for your employees?
In our experience, we listen to our employees. We do a lot of the things. A lot of the business that showed up at the hearing said that they do these things already. And the union's response to that was, well, if you're doing it already, then it doesn't matter. But it does matter because the city changed the way the legislation was being written from the beginning and made it so it actually affects all employers, whether you're good or you're bad, whether you're doing a good job, whether you're doing a bad job. Now, everybody pays penalty pay. No matter what.
Let's talk about this penalty pay. For example, if you can't give your Seattle employees 2 weeks' notice on scheduling changes, you might have to pay them extra. Why is that a problem for
you? Well, honestly, 2 weeks' schedules is not a problem for an employer. An employer can schedule 1 week, 2 weeks, because most of the schedules are common copies with the exception of request off. So there's not much change. So that's not the issue. The issue is with the employees. The employees, to get a 2 week schedule, have to have 3 weeks posted. 3 weeks posted means they have to request stuff off 3 to 4 weeks in advance. Most of our employees don't know what's going on in their lives 3 or 4 weeks in advance. So that's going to end up coming back to the employer where it'll be penalty pay or it'll be extra sick calls because the employee doesn't know how to handle it. So the true issue of this is the employees, not the employers, because employers will adapt to this very easily.
My understanding is that if an employee, for example, calls in sick, you can avoid paying the penalty if you just send out a mass text or email and offer everybody a shift. Is that right?
That's true.
And why is that not a fix for you?
Well, because the insanity of that. The most likely scenario would be that I have an employee that works till 4 p.m. and they called in sick. And now I have an employee that gets off at 1 p.m. and an employee gets off at 2 p.m. I can't just turn around and ask them, can one of you stay till 4? In which case, most likely one of them will volunteer to stay till 4. I have to actually send a text in front of them or behind the door. I have to send a text. So it's really, it sounds like it's, well, that's very reasonable. But for the call in six, it's very unreasonable. For covering someone that doesn't give a 2-week notice, that could be reasonable because you could get a lot of the shifts covered. But that instantaneous moment, it's not reasonable.
I think the city's idea is that when you look at what to use the obvious person, you say, hey, can you cover this? Somebody dropped out. Is that you call it volunteering, but that it might not be so voluntary for the person who might feel on the spot and with a sudden demand from their employer.
And that could be true. In some cases, that could be true. But in many cases, the city is fighting to make sure employees that want more hours, one of their studies said that 20 to 30% of employees want more hours. They're fighting for that in one case of this legislation. They're fighting for that. Well, those people are the ones that usually say yes to covering those shifts because they want more hours. So you're in effect, you're contradicting yourself. You're trying to fight for those employees that want more hours, but then you're putting up a lot of red tape to keep those employees from being able to get those hours.
Is it fair to say you see in this new city law unintended consequences?
There's going to be unintended consequences. I don't agree with the woe is me mentality of a lot of that spoke at the hearing, but
businesses who spoke?
The businesses that spoke, just because of their tone didn't quite capture it. But the fact is that if you're doing a schedule and you have a shift to cover that's a few more hours, like in my scenario of the 4 o'clock, 1 o'clock, there's going to be a point where you're thinking, I can't cover that today because I've taken enough penalty pay this week, so I can't cover it. So there will be employees' loss of hours. It will happen no matter what, and it will happen with the best employers with the best intentions. They will still end up doing that because our margins aren't near as big as the city apparently thinks they are.
This is interesting because you're saying we're not as rich and powerful as you think, because I think the city looks at it like, you know, when scheduling fails – now the burden could fall on a worker who might be barely making rent and childcare. So okay, nothing's perfect, but we're going to shift that burden a little bit to the business.
Right.
Is that wrongheaded?
Well, it is wrongheaded. I gave an example of a water heater going out at one of my stores. It closed me for 3.5 days. The water heater cost $20,000 to replace, and we were closed for 3.5 days. That's a couple months of income for me. So the city and we were able to actually transfer people to some other stores to give them hours that wanted other hours. So the impact on the employees was actually fairly minimal with our effort to try to help them, but it was huge for us. And the union in that particular meeting spoke up and said, it's the employees taking all the burden. It's like they didn't even hear anything that I said about the reality of the situation.
Do you think it's unfair that small business owners are exempt from this secure scheduling legislation, but now franchisees are subject to this?
Well, I think it's very unfair that franchisees are subject to it. Franchisees in Seattle, the bulk of the franchisees in Seattle are minority owners. They're small businesses with 10 or less employees. If this was for 500 or less employees for their entity, then they would be a big business franchise owner, but they're not. They're small business, so they're struggling to make ends meet, and they're affected by this because the city of Seattle doesn't recognize them. Even after pleas from me for them to sit down with small business franchisees and get to know them and see that they're small business, they have refused to do that, and they just choose to look at the banner Subway instead of the people behind that banner that are actually running the businesses.
David, I've had business owners say to me, I don't like X thing the city is doing, but I'm not going to say anything about it because I'm going to get picketed or blackballed. Do you find that? And why are you talking to me right now?
That's happened to two of my friends. So one has been picketed twice and one has been put on a blackball list on a website. I refuse to do that. I think that if the business owner, first off, in the policies that I'm against. It's the lack of an exception for an employee-initiated situation that affects a schedule. And
meaning someone dropping out of a shift.
Someone dropping out of a shift, whether it's call-in or what. That has nothing to do with poor scheduling. Nothing to do with it. So that's what I'm against. I'm not against the city of Seattle trying to improve employees' lives. I'm not against that. But the way they're doing it, they're hitting everybody. So I'm against that. If someone doesn't speak out against it, if everybody just cowers and doesn't speak out, then nothing will happen. It will just go blindly forward. And every time in our past, when we have gone blindly forward without someone speaking up, it has gone on too long. And big changes happen when people speak up. So I refuse to not take care of my staff. I refuse not to care of our family. I refuse to just not speak. I just refuse to do that. I'm not going to do that.
David Jones is a Subway franchisee and founder of the Blazing Onion restaurants. He opposes Seattle's proposed secure scheduling legislation. We also talked to the director of Seattle's Office of Labor Standards, who supports and would enforce this law. We're tweeting out a link to that interview right now at KUOW. 2 weeks ago, when Governor Inslee debated his election opponent, Inslee said Washington has one of America's best economies. The challenger, Republican Bill Bryant, said Washington has one of the highest unemployment rates in the country. Who's right? Seattle Times economics columnist John Talton.
Hi, Bill. They're both right.
How's that?
Well, it's called Seattle and the greater Puget Sound region and then the rest of Washington State. We have one of the most vibrant economies in the country, and we have one of the most diverse economies in the country. But at the same time, we do have an elevated unemployment rate, 5.8%. That's not the end of the world. But the national rate is 4.9%. I think it was about 4.4% in greater Seattle. You have a situation where in a lot of the smaller metros of Washington State, unemployment is elevated. They have less diverse economies. Even Pierce County's unemployment rate is higher than King County's. You have the old legacy economy problems of logging and railroads and jobs that went away and really have never come back. And so it's a more complex situation than just the binary choice of good or bad.
A lot of states have a big city or a couple few big cities and then rural areas. Is there anything special here about Washington State?
We have the same divide economically between the big metro that's doing well and the rural areas that are not doing so well. And this goes all the way back to before the Great Depression. One thing that is interesting about Washington in the West is that it has a lot more smaller towns with fairly large populations for small towns for the West when you compare this to a Colorado or an Arizona or something like that. And a lot of these smaller towns and metros do have elevated unemployment rates.
Does it always have to be this way? Puget Sound area booms, rural Washington sags?
When I went back into the numbers all the way back into the 1980s, I found that Washington State unemployment almost always is somewhat higher than the national rate. And I think part of that has to do with the ups and downs of our aerospace industry and broader manufacturing.
So back to the governor's office, which is where we started. How much credit or blame should we put at the foot of any governor for unemployment?
Yeah, any governor is like a quarterback. If the team is doing well, the quarterback gets more credit than he deserves. And if the team is doing badly, the quarterback gets more blame. Like most Western states, Washington has a relatively weak constitutional governor with most of the power in the hands of the legislature. That said, Christine Gregoire was certainly able to use the power and the suasion of her office, and Gary Locke was too, and several predecessors. And I don't want to get partisan. I think that we do have to give Jay Inslee credit for mastering the learning curve from a representative to an executive as the governor and putting forth some real strategies as far as clean technology and composites and things like this. But he has also faced, and any governor, he or she will face a legislature that will dispose of their plans. And this legislature has been very tightly divided, with control really almost tilting back and forth. And I'm told that there's really only about three or four people in Olympia who matter, who get things done. Most of them are in the legislature. One is certainly the governor, and he or she can make a difference.
Seattle Times economics columnist John Talton. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Bill.
And finally, on KUOW's The Record, as the National Park Service celebrates its 100-year anniversary, we take a closer look at one of those parks here in Washington. Seattle writer Bruce Barcott has spent years exploring Mount Rainier National Park. In fact, he wrote a book about it, Measure of a Mountain. Barcott says there are two sides to Mount Rainier, the family-friendly picnic side and the harsh, unforgiving side.
It's this mountain where most of us who live here in Puget Sound gaze at it from afar and take it as a symbol of beauty. It's, for many of us, it's the reason we live here, in a way. It sums it all up. We're close to nature, and we see it every once in a while. Actually, I live on Bainbridge Island. I rode the ferry in this morning, and Rainier was sort of out like a ghost. You know, it was sort of there in the distance, but it was sort of hiding behind some haze. At the same time, when you get up close, it is a major, massive mountain with glaciers and falling rock and wilderness. And, you know, I wrote this book many years ago on Mount Rainier, and the sort of point of the book was to throw this naive narrator onto the mountain. And in a way, I'm lucky I didn't die. I was just put myself into the forest, into the high mountain meadows and onto the glaciers, and ultimately made a summit climb of Mount Rainier. But the more you spend time on the mountain, the more you have to treat it with respect and come away with an awe that is tinged with a little fear.
Most of us, almost all of us, are naive narrators when we say anything about Mount Rainier, right? Why did you want to end that naivete?
I was fascinated by the way in which people seemed to form this personal relationship with Mount Rainier. And even newcomers to the region would call it, oh, my mountain. My mountain is out. Oh, I love Mount Rainier. Have you ever been there? No, I've never been there, but I love it. It's like, why do we form this you know, pretended relationship with this mountain? So that was sort of the beginning of the journey, to try to answer that question of why we form this relationship with the mountain. And I think there's something about just the visual of Mount Rainier, and it's not a beautiful peak. It's not a perfect triangle. It's more like a slumped, melting piece of ice cream cone. But it does stand alone, and we tend to, you know, look up to the heavens, if you will, to think about things like the afterlife or our place in the universe. We tend not to gaze down at large holes and do that, mm-hmm. You know. And so it sort of inspires those thoughts in us. And I think that's a part of it.
You embedded yourself with search and rescue volunteers on Rainier. What did you learn doing that?
That was fascinating. I had set it up. So I was working on a feature story about search and rescue in the national parks. So I think it was probably early fall, they had a search and rescue camp come up. There was a couple, they were overdue. It was probably Monday, maybe Tuesday. You know, it's always somebody's coworker calls in because they're not showing up at their desk. And that was the case here. They had gone up the mountain via the Nisqually Glacier route, so people were out looking for them. And I was sort of there in Longmire at the search and rescue headquarters, just watching all these people work. And they have a very elaborate protocol for doing what they do and sending out teams and this sort of thing. And we would get various reports coming back now and then throughout the morning. But at one point, there was a call from one of the ranger teams over the radio, and they said code black, which I don't know if it still is, but at the time it was code for we have found a dead body. And they immediately said, but we don't think that it's the people we're looking for because it's a singular person. It's not a couple. And in fact, we know it's not the people we're looking for because it's been here a while. And it turned out that they had run across a snowboarder who had gone missing about a year or two earlier on the Nisqually Glacier. And he basically had gone up the mountain, the Camp Muir route, and gone off track and had fallen and died. And the mountain sort of kept him there for a couple of years. And usually the mountain will keep anybody who dies there pretty much forever. But it brought home to me the fact that there are a number of people who go up to the mountain and never come back. And it's ultimately unforgiving in that way. It's this thing of beauty that we love, but really the mountain really doesn't care about you. It doesn't care what weather, you know, rolls in on you, and it will roll in on you very quickly.
You summited Mount Rainier, and I'm always curious about that. I know lots of non-climbers, you know, who wanted to walk up that thing, and I haven't been that tempted because it seems like a long slog toward an almost predictable end when you compare it to all the trouble you're going through. It's not like serendipity. I came around the corner and oh my God.
Yeah.
Do you know what
absolutely.
I'm talking about?
No, absolutely. And that is the experience. I mean, I wrote an entire book on Mount Rainier. I spent 3 years working on it. I summited once. And I had to will myself up the mountain during that climb because I didn't want to have to come back and do it again. I mean, I went up and trained hard for it. It's impossible to overtrain for that climb. And it is just a long slog up the mountain, up these glaciers, but it's not just a slog. There are dangerous parts. It's very, extremely risky. I went up with Rainier Mountaineering guides, and I was amazed at how much risk they took on every day as a part of their job. They made it as safe as possible, but it's not safe. There's a lot of risk involved. And then once you get up at the top, it's sort of this cream of wheat bowl of snow, and that's about it. You know, you can see a long ways in the distance, but you're so gassed by the time you get up there. You're so busted. And then you've got to get down safely, and that's going to require some energy as well. So I basically, you know, got up to the top, made a few notes, threw on my jacket. We sat around for about 20 minutes and shook hands, and then got ourselves back down the mountain.
This is about what I imagined. Yeah. You're not making me want to climb Mount Rainier.
No. In fact, one of the things I loved about Rainier was going up to about the 10,000 foot level. The summit is 14,411 feet. At the 10,000 foot level, there are two climbing camps on opposite sides of the mountain. And if you go up there, it's about the highest you can go kind of as a civilian. You don't have to have crampons or anything like that to get up there. It is a long hike. But once you're up there at 10,000 feet, you have most of what you experience higher on the mountain, except, you know, you don't have the incredible pain and energy and drudgery of getting all the way back up and down. So I loved going up there and spending time up there.
Let's talk about Rainier as a national park, since this is kind of why we're talking about it again. National parks turning 100 years old. Who have you met in Rainier National Park that stuck with you?
People that always remain in my head are Åke and Branka Sundström, who were a couple from Europe. Branka actually survived the Holocaust, met her husband Åke after the war, and they moved over to Puget Sound. And they had retired at the very edge of the national park, and they would go up and they'd make that slog up to Camp Muir and back 50 times a year. I mean, for me to do it in my late 20s, I had to prepare for it. I was sore in bed the next day, always. They were doing it 50 times a year, and they went out with just the most amazing attitude. You know, I did that hike a couple times with Branka. You know, I'm a tall, thin man. I have a high metabolism. I need a lot of food. And Branka would always go up with a little bag of carrots. He'd say, "Oh, Bruce, you do not need that candy. You do not need that. Just have some carrots and continue on." I'm like, "Branka, I'm dying here." But she had the most amazing attitude. I said, "How do you do this time after time? I mean, it's the same route." And she says, "Oh, no. She says, "Every time you're in the mountains, you see the world with new eyes." And she really did. She went out and it was also true that the mountain changes so quickly through the seasons that you kind of do see it with new eyes every time you go out. So she remains with me. Åke passed away about 6 years ago, but Branka is still out there going. There was actually an article that she went up to Camp Muir a few weeks ago to celebrate probably her 92nd birthday, but she's still going strong.
So for somebody who hasn't been to Rainier National Park, yet or rarely. Mm-hmm. Give us a tip. What's something we should do?
On a sunny day, go to Paradise. I mean, it's going to be crowded. The parking lot's going to be full. But just go anyway and start at the parking lot and start walking up. And you, even though there will be many people there on a sunny summer afternoon, you are likely to run across a freaking marmot, you know, and it will put out this crazy high-pitched scream like, ee! I'm embarrassing myself trying to do it, but it's this high-pitched squeal, and it doesn't care that you're there, really. It's like it's getting on with the business of life. Or, you know, you may run across a crew of climbers coming down from a terribly difficult summit climb, and they're haggard, and they're walking the same trail you are, and you might run across, you know, an Everest climber who's done, you know, the Himalayas 10 years of the last 12. Or you may run into, you know, a new family of immigrants from India who are there and seeing snow for the very first time in their lives. I can't tell you how many times I had that experience. It's just fantastic. But I think Paradise is the place to start. There are plenty of other gems around the mountain, plenty of other entrances and ways to experience the mountain. But, you know, Paradise still, it's like, you know, if you go to Yosemite, you've got to go see El Capitan. And if you go to Rainier, you've got to go up to Paradise.
Seattle-based writer Bruce Barcott wrote the book Measure of a Mountain, Beauty and Terror on Mount Rainier. And if you think a few hours on Rainier is punishing, you're going to learn what it's like to simulate being on Mars for a year coming up this afternoon when we bring you KUOW's All Things Considered. Hope you can join us.